You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
¿Cómo está, Mike?
I've been practicing that all day.
And next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Ugh.
And across the table, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hola, Miguel.
Ooh, wow. Whoa. Look at that.
Man.
Well, gang, the reason why everybody's talking in an accent, except me, is because today is Cinco de Mayo. And we had Mexican beer.
More beer.
So,
making love in a canoe.
It should be really interesting. Today we have a great guest. Today, joining us for the Audio Nowcast, we have producer Greg Pagani.
All right, Greg.
No hablo.
Greg's a producer, engineer, programmer. He does it all, and he's worked with some amazing people, from Leanne Rimes to Babyface. And why don't you give us a little bit of your bio, Greg?
Let's see. My bio started with the 3LW. Little girl group on Sony Epic 10 years ago now. That record went platinum, and as a result of being on that album, I got a publishing deal with Desmond Child.
Nice.
So Desmond was working on Leanne Rimes' new album. So we had a writing camp in Miami, brought down all kinds of top-level writers, and I got to hang out in the room with some of the good ones and work on a few songs, and we ended up producing the entire album. And that was a great thing. I ended up doing a couple more albums with Leanne, did a Christmas album and a song with her for our European album. As a result of that, met a good guy named Robbie Neville, you guys may know. Great songwriter, artist in himself.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to Babyface. So I ended up working with Babyface on an album of his called Grown and Sexy. Did a couple things with him, another album with Patti LaBelle. He does an album of covers and a few things with him for a couple years. We worked together. And recently worked with Charlie Wilson on what has been a number one single for 7 weeks. He had a number one R&B album.
All right.
And what single is that?
It's called There Goes My Baby.
Great.
So that was a number one Urban AC single for 7 weeks. So now just developing some artists, trying to get some of my own stuff going and keep it going.
And you've joined us in the Audio Nowcast.
Here I am, the epitome of my career here
exactly.
At the podcast.
Actually, wow. I just blackmailed him. I got some pictures.
Well, hey, thanks for coming and joining us
thanks
today.
For having me.
Also joining us today on the Audio Nowcast, we have Brandon Birdside from Trailer Park.
Hello.
Hey, Brandon.
Hi, Brad.
Brandon's is a composer. What? Composer, sound designer, what's your exact
composer name? / sound designer, whatever.
Yeah, Brandon actually does a lot
make
of
noise.
Really cool sound effects for a lot of the big trailers that you see out there. Did you do anything on Up?
Whooshes and booms. I did some minor things on Up. Nothing that I could pick out of the mix once it was mixed. So,
but,
little things.
Dialogue, music,
sound. So,
exactly.
So, Brandon, thank you for stopping by and sitting with us. One thing I want to talk about, guys, is the before we get going, I want to talk about the Avid rebrand. I don't know if you guys are familiar with what's happening, but Avid is basically trying to save.
See, my son likes it because there's all those triangles. Name the shape.
Yeah, they're trying to save the company because, you know, Avid's taken such a hit by Apple, and they came out with a new logo, and DigiDesign is going to be, you know, Avid DigiDesign, and M-Audio is Avid M-Audio. And I don't know, I just think it's kind of a desperate move, and I think the logo is ugly. I mean, Rob, what do you think?
Well, I don't think the logo has been their problem for the last few years, honestly. And so it does seem like however much money they spent on graphics for the logo, they could have put into some product development, I would think. I don't know. I don't think it's all that exciting.
Yeah, if you go on the web and you just, you know, you see what's happening, a lot of people in DigiDesign are afraid that there's going to be brand confusion. And
oh, there's
that,
definitely going to be brand confusion.
And it's going to hurt DigiDesign in the long run because of all the companies, DigiDesign was the one that was kind of, you know.
And the new logo also, the new logo with all, like, it's fine if it just has a solid color in it or some basic treatment, but they're putting pictures inside of it, and then you don't get what it is. It just
looks
messy.
Avid should be like the post-production brand, and Digi should be the like, most.
I was going to say, are they branding it entirely? Is it going to be Avid Pro Tools now?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be Avid Pro Tools. They haven't gone that far. People are afraid.
Okay, so you're passing rumors here.
No.
It's going to be Avid DigiDesign.
It's going to be Avid DigiDesign. That's for sure.
That's a mistake.
Until Sony buys it, the Sony Avid DigiDesign.
Yeah. I don't know. I just
sick of miles. All those long names, you know.
Well, is the bulk of their the users in post production or in music? Because the post production people obviously are familiar with Avid, but the music people are not.
Right. Well, that's just it. Avid is all post production people, and DigiDesign is all music people. It's you know what?
But it's like picture people versus sound people. It's not like there's that much.
Overlap. It's a little bit of everything. I mean, that's what Digi really is. Digi's kind of made a product that's kind of a little bit for everybody, but not totally everything for.
But you know what? The idea of changing a logo sounds like a bunch of bean counters who had no idea what the products do or what the customers want or anything else got together.
It coincided with a major launch of a new style of
product. Yeah, no, but it's not that at all.
But when Avid bought DigiDesign, the ego is in the Avid world, and when Avid stopped becoming as important, I mean, like, Avid still is important. I mean, it's not like they're out. The problem is they've already hit saturation.
Right.
So everybody that needs an Avid has one. And not only that, there's so many Avids you can rent. Why buy?
That's true.
It's not like people are buying Avids, but you can rent them and you can keep buying more. But most of the people that get Avids now, all the studios, all the films, they don't buy them, they rent them.
Right.
So I think at that point, they're as big as they're going to get. Individuals buy Final Cut, companies buy Avids. But Avid's still, I mean, it's like I read an article about the iPhone and the BlackBerry, and they're like, the BlackBerry storm is just on fire. The percentages are up. But the iPhone still has more customers out there by far than they do.
Right.
So it depends if you play the percentage game against the actual game. Avid still is a de facto standard out there. Final Cut is definitely making headway. But Avid still has a majority lead on that.
Yeah. And I just think the logo's ugly.
I think it's a little confusing unless it's presented simply, but also it was a solution in search of a problem. I don't think anybody was saying the problem with Avid is the logo.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
I think the logo is clever, actually. I actually like the logo, to be honest.
But that's because you know Avid. If you were just looking at that, those blocks of symbols, you'd have no freaking clue.
Right. Generally, a logo change is for a re-identification of a company or a product, and then if they're not changing anything other than the logo, what's the point?
Definitely. And I know they trade on the NASDAQ, AVID, shorter to $12.
But you got
down to overpriced.
But Logic took a big amount of thunder out of Digi. So maybe rebranding, giving something exciting, you know, reinventing themselves. Who knows?
Yeah, but you know what? The people who use Logic never heard of Avid. I mean, they're not going
to. No, but it's a new product. Digi goes Avid. Oh, it's something new, something sexy. Look, people in technology like something new. It's not like, I don't like to touch anything new. I like the old stuff. People like the new stuff. And if there's something new and exciting and they rebrand it, all of a sudden, I mean, Final Cut was Macromedia. But nobody knows that. So it's rebranded Final Cut. It's Apple. No, it's Macromedia.
Whatever it is, it's good.
Yeah,
it kicks their butt, man.
So that's what's going to happen. But you didn't know Macromedia. But now, people that won't know, you know, Avid will learn Avid.
I did know Macromedia. Oh, okay. Sounded at 16. Director. Yeah, yeah, I know. Come on, I'm plugged in. All right, well, moving on. We'll see what happens. We'll see how that plays out. It just, to me, I would agree with Rob. It was a solution in search of a problem. And you know, let's face it, there's a little bit of desperation there, I think. So let's move on to, let's talk about R&B. Greg, you have a lot of experience in R&B with your work with Babyface and with your work with Charlie Wilson. And when you start a project, especially something as specific as R&B, you know, how do you approach that type of work as opposed to, let's say, if you're working on something country with Leanne Rimes? I mean, what kind of mindset do you have to get into when you start an R&B project?
Well, there actually are sort of subsets of R&B, if you will. You know, someone like a Charlie Wilson is doing a more traditional R&B music that's based less in sort of the hip-hop world. You know, the younger R&B artists are really sort of hip-hop music with singing over the top of it, which is it really comes down to. There's not the traditional chord progressions and instrumentation of real R&B. So it depends on whether you're dealing with a young artist or an older artist and right. what particular style you're doing, a sort of retro thing or a modern thing. So it, depending on what it is, you
let's,
know, you
well, let's just talk a modern R&B, you know, along the lines of not necessarily hip-hop, because that definitely has its own unique production environment, let's say.
Right.
But more of a classic R&B, more like kind of like the Charlie Wilson stuff, kind of right. along those lines.
It's tough for any artist, even an artist like Charlie Wilson, who's fairly legendary, because to get on the radio nowadays, you're competing with the kids and the hip hop stuff. Even urban adult, as they call it, urban contemporary R&B, basically has all the has Beyonce and all the younger artists on there now, and the style of music that's underneath that singing is based in hip hop. So somebody like Charlie is trying to ride the line between the two styles. So he has some songs on the album that are more traditional with, you know, live instrumentation, for example, right. live guitars, live bass, but no live drums anywhere on the album. Mm-hmm. it's still all programmed stuff. Things programmed to feel live, but it's still synthetic.
Was it MPC or is it more sequenced like Cubase?
The stuff I did was all sequenced, and gotcha. The stuff is primarily, it's computer-based music for the most part with live stuff thrown on the top. You know, the only place you'll really hear live instrumentation on R&B anymore is if it's sort of a retro-style album or what they call, you know, the neo-soul sort of stuff, which is really just kind of retro music. So it's based in computer music primarily, and it's based in the hip-hop simple, it's really simple, technically simple, but the simplicity is deceiving, you know, because it's not an easy sound to achieve necessarily to be authentic.
Well, that's true. So,
it's an interesting thing that happened with Charlie Wilson track. Greg can explain with
the
sample replacement.
Yeah. We had the track was based on the sample initially. So it was a hip hop style track that was just basically a sample loop with some parts played over the top.
Of an old band. The band is an old recording.
Yeah, Rolls Royce.
Rolls
Royce. And couldn't use the sample. It was too costly. So we had to recreate the sample elements and replay everything so we didn't have to pay a master use fee. And Bob actually helped me. I did a sort of reproduction of it, but it was not quite all the way there. And Bob took some of his...
Because I'm old.
Engineering expertise and made it sound a little bit more authentic, matched the sample sound pretty well, quite well.
Actually. What did you do, Bobby?
Just use old technology. But because the Rolls Royce track, which it was now, Rick said, here's the original, and here's what I've done.
Right.
And what he did was great. He played everything correctly. But, you know, when you have samples and they're all exactly correct, and, you know, it doesn't smudge as well as the thing. So first things first, in those days, people used analog tapes to pre-delay gold foil plates, 140 EMT.
So that's the scary thing about Bob, just to interrupt for a second. He could listen to it, and he knew precisely all the gear that had been used. Oh, that's this, that. He knew the flanger, the reverb, everything.
I know.
Scary.
It's kind of sick.
Anyway, so that's what I did. I just said, okay, well, that's what they did this. Obviously, I didn't have an EMT 140 or have a tape delay, but I said, well, I know how they, you know, so it was just a matter of trial and error, really. And just also, a lot of people today use compressors, and they go, oh, it's compressed, but the old days, compressors were much slower. They were opto-coupled,
right.
lots of them. So when they would compress, they'd be, like, really lazy. So the beat would go past, like, okay, I'll compress now. So it made things sound like bushy and whoosh. Like all that, like furry sounding.
Right.
Whereas the new technology doesn't. It's all like hard and snappy and all like strangled sounding.
Wait, is that what gives it that furry sound? Is that compressor? Because I was wondering how, because you hear those drums, it almost sounds like they're sloppy,
it's
but like they're
the
not.
LA2A, right?
I'm sorry?
Like the LA2?
Well, LA2A is one. Yep. 1176 is another one. Yep. Fairchild 670 is another one. Yep. But anyway, and also analog tape itself does that in a way too.
Yeah. Right.
In a sloppy kind of way too. So anyway.
So yeah, that song is envisioned. People refer to it as a very retro track, but it's quite modern technology all over it, and the music is quite simple. It's very repetitive, but it has a good sort of old school feel to it. So, to your original question of how you approach that kind of music now, it's fairly modern. It's really a lot like hip hop, and it just depends on, you know, actually, and it's actually evolving rapidly, and it's really sort of switching into, because the retro music now is 80s music. The kids growing up now, the music, their nostalgic music is the 80s.
Right.
So, people
damn
are
kids.
More, you know, but it's more pop oriented, more, the chord changes are sort of changing and evolving. It's a little bit different than it was 8 or 10 years ago. Right. So, you know, you approach it. Mostly everybody wants to sound like what's on the radio. And so you start there and look at what's popular and start going from that.
So hip-hop Devo style.
Exactly.
Well, let's be specific. Like, one thing that you know, is typical in an R&B production is the vocals are just in your face. I mean, they're just right there. What kind of mics do you like to go for? What kind of – are you like Avalon mic preamp with a Sony mic? I mean, what's your go-to?
That's a popular choice. The Sony is popular for those that can afford it. I personally have a couple of Sound Deluxe mics. I really like the 47. I have a U99 and a 251. Depending on the singer.
Hook me up. You
know? Yeah, go Sound Deluxe. But,
yeah, those are great mics.
It went the way of the DigiDesign logo.
Yeah, but I really like those mics. But you know, people, that style of music is done in a variety of ways. Also, it's from top end stuff. Like I said, you might be a major studio on a Sony mic to someone's, you know, closet at their apartment on a Audio Technica or something that's very inexpensive but still sounds fine in the end. So I personally like the 47, and I have a Vintech Mic Pre that I really like, which is like an Eve remake sort of, and a Tube Tech compressor. I like that chain a lot.
Rob, so, when you do your R&B, what do you usually like to get that R&B in your face vocal style? What do you usually use in your vocal chain?
It really depends on the singer.
Really? Still? Yeah. I mean, you won't limit because you're going for a specific sound to a specific mic pre?
No. I mean, if it's a real singer, we usually use some kind of big capsule condenser.
Right.
Like a Neumann 149 or, you know, some of the stuff Greg was mentioning. I mean, they're all really good, but you just have to try it on the singer and see what's magic.
Yeah, basically. There is a huge difference from mic to mic with the different singers. I'll put the same microphone. I'll use the sound, the U99, for example, which is kind of like a Neumann 67.
Right.
And some singers sound incredibly sibilant and just not good on it at all. And some sound very rich and warm. It's amazing the difference just from individuals to how different they sound on the same mic.
And a lot of times, if we find the perfect mic for a singer, we'll actually tell them, okay, this is your mic. You know, anytime somebody asks you, what do you want to use, definitely put this in the list.
Really?
But mic pre-wise, actually recently we've been using a Massenburg just because it's so clean and it doesn't do much to the sound and you can basically do anything you want to the sound afterwards.
Right.
But if we want character, we've actually been going to the Millennia mic pre. And I like the idea of finding new equipment that sounds as good as the old stuff. I think it's kind of crazy to think that.
The Viper sounds very good.
The what?
The Viper. Have you checked that big?
Oh, yeah, the Viper, because it does lovely resistance matching.
Yeah, you can do impedance matching. I love screwing around with that.
Oh,
yeah.
I have to play with that.
Yeah, it's a big old tubey thing.
The thing is, I have a hard time thinking that the only way to get a good sound is to use something 40 years old. You know, it shouldn't be the case as technology evolves. So there are definitely some new products out there that
wish that was true,
right,
we'd have more work.
And you have 20-year-old people using 40-year-old technology.
So is it like, you know, in R&B, do you have to use an 808 on every track?
It's in the Constitution.
Again, that's what I was referring to. It's just the trends, you know. Yeah. It's just people always – and, I talked to Bob about this a number of times where people like to be nostalgic about music. You know, they used to be of this certain quality or this type of thing happened back in these days. And I disagree. I think that people have always – imitated whatever is popular, and the 808's popular right now. It's popular in the 80s, and it's popular again. And people just tend to be drawn towards whatever they hear a lot, and they like that sound, so they emulate it.
And it kind of always works.
Yeah, it does.
Well, definitely. I mean, since it's so clean, there's not a lot of reverb. You definitely have a lot of room for that 808 just to tail.
That's such a good point. It's not a root. R&B is no reverb.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, not a great deal of reverb.
I think you'll get a ticket if you put a reverb in an album.
But then, you know, every time you think that, you'll hear a new record come out that's huge and it'll be soaking wet. The rules change rapidly. So
I have to admit, we put reverb on R&B. Yeah. Not a lot, but there is reverb.
Actually, good. There's an engineer that I've used to mix on a lot of records named Serban Genia. I have a hard time pronouncing his last name. But he's quite a bit of reverb and delay on that. I noticed when we were working on the mixes, he stopped it, you know, and you hear a lot of long reverbs, but he's subtle with how he uses them, and they're mixed back in the mix in an interesting way. So when you hear the record,
nice,
it sounds pretty dry.
A little bit of glue.
But it's quite a bit of juice in there. Yeah, it's interesting.
What's the guy's name?
Serbengenia. I don't know how to pronounce it. G-H-E-N-E-A. He's out of Virginia Beach. He's mixed a lot of big records.
Yeah, I'd like to hear some of his stuff. Cause that, you know, I'm with Rob. If you put just a little bit on the back end, sometimes it's enough to tie it in.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't interfere with the, you know, 808.
Sure.
Talking of 808, I set up one the other day, and I've got one, and I set it up and sampled it, and I put it into
the actual machine.
The actual machine, the drum machine. I have an 808, the old thing. Excuse me. The old thing. But I actually sampled the bass drum, and you turn it up all the way, and it goes boom, big long thing. But if you take it and put it on a mono, patch in like a sampler,
right,
and you play it back and use as a bass part, it's really, really nice.
You know what? There was a great plugin that I think is now gone from FXpansion called the DR008. Any of you used that?
I don't know that one.
It's the closest thing to a software 808.
Really?
It actually has a drum system in it called the 809 because it's sort of a cross
between
the
808.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
That thing you can actually like set up kick drum in that and play it melodically, and it's really good. It's sort of a secret weapon.
That's
and it's okay to talk about it because I don't think you can get it anymore. But if you ever come across a DR008, it's really good.
Interesting.
Well, that whole 808 and 909 bass drum is so, I mean, when you hear the real machines do that, that's just...
It's all iconic, isn't it?
Well, that's great. So when you work with these, with the R&B and it's time to mix, do you have like any particular approach that you use? I mean, do you bring up the bass and then add the vocals and, you know, try to set them in, or do you start with the vocal and kind of wrap everything around it?
For mixing, generally I pick up my phone and call a good mixing engineer. I mix my songs generally as for demo purposes for the most part. I've had some things end up on records, but I like to at that point sort of separate myself from the process just to have another person's input. And but my own sort of mixing method, yeah, it's, you know, the way with using Pro Tools and all the computer-based stuff now, it kind of mixes itself as it goes. You know, right, as you're recording the vocals and you work on the track, it's kind of an evolving process. So I might work on the thing as I'm recording. I'll work on the track initially, then you record the vocals, you work on it a little more, and then you edit the vocals and put things together. And so the mix sort of takes place as you go along the whole way. So there isn't really a point where I start from zero and mix it from the bottom up,
good to have someone else do that. Definitely.
Right, which is, yeah. So my mixes generally sort of start with everything in, and I've just been tweaking it as I go, and it ends up kind of being finished that way. So
when you do work with a mixer, are you like, okay, why don't you give it a first pass, and I'll come back in an hour or 2 hours and kind of
yeah,
you know,
I used to like to hang around and watch them from the ground up, but I became an annoyance, I think. I think, you know, it's actually, you lose perspective too when you do it that way. It's easier to come in late in the process and just hear everything pretty much finished. So that's what I do now. I'll let them do their thing and then come in and just make fine tuning little moves, little tweaks. And it's usually, if you get the right guy, you know, hopefully you get a guy who understands where you're trying to go
right,
with it.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
For a mixer, it's nice to be left alone for at least
definitely
the dirty part of it, because you're like, first of all, you're listening to the track and you're trying to become familiar with what's going on and where tracks are, and
right,
and you're screwing up and you're trying ideas too, so you don't really want the producer standing over your shoulder for the first 4 hours at least.
Well, that's where you wear a shirt on the back, says, yeah, I know.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I know.
Well, it's like the rate card. You know, it's $1,000 if you want me to mix it, $2,000 if you want to watch, $3,000 if you want to help.
Yeah, imagine really doing true. Your entire workday having to explain every single thing that you're doing as you're doing it.
And why you're doing it. I won't say who it is, but I was mixing a track for somebody at Capitol Records, and we had this massive, quite big console, and I'm doing mute passes into the computer in automation days. And the assistant engineer, I said, do me a favor, just man that mute for me, and we'll tell you when we want it on or off. And then the artist was there saying, oh, no, well, I want to be part of this. I'm like, oh, here we go again. It was like just a ball of tracks. So we're doing this thing, and then the assistant said, do you want it on? And the artist said, yes. So on. Do you want it off? Off. And then comes the middle age, she says, do you want it on? She says, I don't know. She said, and the assistant said, I don't have a don't know button here. It's quite funny. Quite hilarious.
Well, you know, it's such
a sarcastic way.
Such a fragile, I guess fragile is probably the wrong word, but this is a unique relationship between a producer and a mixer, because the producer kind of has the vision and the mixer has to get to where the producer's vision is, you know, be it in film or post-production or whatever. It's kind of this delicate little thing, because as a mixer, you know, I'm trying to figure out what my client wants. And the client hears it a certain way, but sometimes doesn't know how to communicate what he's hearing. And so I find that when I work with a producer who really knows how to communicate, you tend to get the best results. The worst ones are the ones – I like producers that are kind of heavy-handed, that they say, yeah, that sucks, or no, that's great. It's the ones that get wishy-washy. That are the ones that
I think to differentiate between music producers and engineers and TV and or film producers and engineers is very different, because
No, that's true too. You're absolutely right.
A music producer and engineer was in this situation on both sides of that fence. It's actually a creative partnership in a way, and they normally hire the engineer, and you normally work with the producer that you're on the same wavelength, and you normally understand what was trying to gotten at, out of that track. So, and you're normally asked to mix it for your, hopefully for your personality. You're not really necessarily just asked to be a knob slob in a way. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
To a certain degree. And of course, there's some stars where they say, no, I really want to focus on this part and this B section. Don't go switching it off, you know, or something like that. So I think there's a different relationship for music producers, but it's certainly nice to have somebody who knows what they want.
That dynamic has also changed, you know, with the modern thing. Now everything has become very disposable and instant in the record business anyway. My experience has shown that the demo is the record now. You don't really get a chance much to demo things, and an engineer doesn't get much opportunity to take something really and strip it all down and build it up again. It's kind of like, you know, as a producer, you have to have some engineering skills to get the thing presentable in the first place. And people then generally grow pretty attached to that. The demo fever is worse than ever, I think, because of the digital format and the fact that it's already kind of sounds done. It's pretty clean and sounds good.
Right.
So if you get it to a point where people like it, often the mix engineer has to kind of match that, but make it better if you can. But it really isn't
that much hard of
a difference. It's a tough task for engineers now. But that's how it's changed. It's just how it is.
Do you know who's really notorious for producing really great demos? And Martin, because Martin Page is another friend of ours who's on the podcast once every year. he can mix. He mixes his own demos and then makes it to whatever mixer he's working with. And he is really particular. So I can only imagine, but you know, he's working with Mike Shipley. So obviously
played me a demo last night of his new one. It sounded great.
He's a good mixer, isn't he?
Yeah, he's got good ears. I mean,
he definitely does.
All you need is ears. End of the book. And so true. All you need is.
Well, hey, we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a few things, but I want to, you know, thanks, Greg, for giving us an insight in R&B and some stuff, and we'll finish visiting with him on the other side. So we'll see you then.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were getting schooled by Greg on R&B.
Greg took us to school.
That's a scary thought.
You know, to kind of finish up the conversation on that, when you go from that to something like you know, the Leanne Rimes stuff, is it a total culture shock for you?
Absolutely. Actually, that was true culture shock for me. I went from traditionally doing R&B stuff for the most part. Then I went to the writing camp I mentioned in Miami with Desmond. And this was these are pop writers, well-known people, very successful. And it was just mind-blowing to me. It was 10 a.m. start. Everything was a schedule. We met at the beginning of the day. You know, everyone had a discussion about what was going to happen. We're going to write from 10 to noon, break for lunch for an hour. Then we write from 2:30 to 5, have dinner, then write from 6:30 till 9. And then it was like just so regimented. I had never encountered that before in my life. But the people that were there, they were used to that, and they were very productive in that. They were all very talented. So they'd come in, it's like, okay, go. Okay, here's how the song's going to end. They just start writing. and cranking them out. I was just shocking, but it was really eye-opening. I'd never done it before, and it was a totally different way to do it, and it works for doing that. The stuff that they do, they're very good at.
And how many songs were written in that?
Well, they had, how many people were down at that one? There were probably, I'd say there were 12 people down there. They're broken up into twos and threes, and so we were there for, I think we were there for a 4-day weekend or something. So they probably, I'm sure they came away with 12 or 15 songs, and I think a bunch of them made the everything I worked on. I think I did 3 songs that weekend, and 2 of the 3 ended up on the album. So
wow,
it was cool. It was very different, very different.
How was it working with Desmond? He's like a musical genius.
He's a songwriting genius. True. It was interesting. It was a different experience for me. I'd never worked in that style. Again, this was the opposite of what I told you about the R&B stuff. This was mostly live instruments. There was programming stuff too, but there were, live drums, piano, all the instruments were added on in addition to the program stuff. The program stuff was actually more of an afterthought than the live stuff. So that was an interesting thing. And there were some back and forths on the songs and the styles that were going on. So there was a lot of sort of deconstructing, reconstructing going on in that project. So it was very, very different for me, but it was great because it kind of rounded me out a lot more and opened me up to do other kinds of music and projects than I had done previously. So.
And Desmond is a character and a half.
Quite the character. Yes.
We could leave it at that, probably. With him. I worked with him for a short time a few years back, and he's a character and a half.
Oh, come on. You got to – funny, esoteric?
No, actually really funny. I mean, we got to hear a lot of stories about him and then a lot of stories from him. But it was a really unique situation because it was working on a Christmas thing and we were working out here at my studio, so he was kind of out of his element. But it was an interesting experience. I just remember he sent us a note afterwards. I still have it someplace. It says something like, Dear Noisy Neighbors, the name of my company. Dear Noisy Neighbors, you guys are the shit. Love, Desmond. I saved that note. I have it someplace.
It was the interesting contrast to me was that environment was more cerebral. It was very calculated, thought out, intellectually accomplished, as opposed to the R&B stuff I've worked on, which was much more heartfelt, sort of just improvised and just off the cuff, so to speak. People just come up with ideas, and you put things out there, and you kind of build it from that. This stuff was much more structured.
It's like factory work, isn't it?
Very much so. It was fascinating
stuff.
To me.
Yeah, different way to do it.
They're very good at it, so I respect both styles very much.
Did you feel intimidated?
I did, absolutely, because it was so foreign to me, and they were all so good at what they were doing. There's a guy named Gary Burr who's written a number of big country and pop hits, and just amazing talent. The guy's just chord progressions all over the place. How about can sing his butt off? So he's singing all these ideas and just amazing how they would come up with lyric melody and chord progressions. Just amazing.
That must be
intimidating to me because I'm not musically trained. So I plunk around and find my stuff that I need to find. And I've learned a lot since then. I know much more than I did then. But at the time, it was intimidating.
Man,
it was great.
That would scare the bejeebies out of me.
It was going down the course, and you're like, well, I've got...
Yeah.
Okay. It's pretty awesome.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Definitely scary.
I remember the first time I went to work for Stevie Wonder. I had been doing backline tech for forever, and I remember the first day when Stevie walked in, I was nervous as anything, because it's like, oh my gosh, it's Stevie Wonder, and you just feel so unworthy. At least I did.
But you grow out of that with time.
What I found as having worked on a number of projects now with fairly big name people is that it's really not that much different than the stuff you were already doing as you're learning coming up. Everybody kind of has it's all the same thing in the end, and it's just a matter of working with different personalities and whatnot, but the process of making the music is ultimately kind of the same thing,
Well, that's cool.
So, yeah.
Well, and obviously you were at that level and beyond because of, 2 or 3 songs made it onto the album and stuff. So
right.
That was,
at that time,
that was kind of cool.
I felt fortunate, but it was great. It was a lot of fun and a big, great learning experience. So.
Wow. Well, hey, thanks. Thanks for telling us all that. That's some really great advice. Let me ask you one last thing. If somebody wanted to get into R&B, specifically, you know, being a songwriter. Do you have any great little nuggets of advice?
And they can't just be nuggets. They have to be great nuggets. No great pressure, nuggets. Though.
That's right.
Specifically as a songwriter?
Yeah. Coming from a producer-songwriting point of view, that you have?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. From a producer, there's sort of the two sides. There are people that are just strictly writers that I've worked with. And in R&B, generally the writers are fairly good singers. Not everybody, of course, but generally they're singers, so they come from that sort of point of view. Initially, they are literally singing melody ideas and things like that.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So if you're just getting into that business and you're a writer in that way, you almost have to find a producer to work with. You have to output as much material as you can. It's because the advent of the digital production and all these things in the computers has made things somewhat disposable. You know, there's so much material out there, and you just have to crank out so much material. It's judged so quickly, so you can't get your feelings too caught up in things, you know, because you're going to be, you may have to record 30 songs. Literally, the artists now, particularly the R&B stuff, the artists now record 60, 80 songs to complete an album before an album is chosen of 10 or 12 songs.
Wow.
And they're just recording and recording and recording. So if you want to be a songwriter, you got to write a lot of songs. You got to crank them out and get with some producers and get your stuff recorded.
Do you listen to a lot of new stuff being a producer?
I do. I try to keep up on what's going on, but it comes at you so fast. There's so much stuff, so I pay attention to what's popular, and I keep my eye out for new stuff that's kind of under the radar. I find some cool things. There's a lot of great stuff online in addition to a lot of not so great stuff, so you have to kind of sift through it.
Yeah. Cool. Wow. That's an education right there. And we don't even charge for it. Hey, Rob, there's Noisy Neighbors. Do you listen to a lot of new songwriters? Can somebody submit stuff to you, or do you generally just have your sources that you like to go to?
Actually, at this point, now that we have an independent label and we have so many things going on, I'm sorry to say I don't get that much chance to listen to new stuff, but I now have partners who check out new stuff and who are constantly scouring the web and getting submissions and hearing what's going on out there. I really enjoy diving in and listening to new stuff, but I find if I do that, it eats up my whole day. So I try to, every now and then I'll do like a data dump and learn as much as I can about what's going on, and then I'll kind of put myself back in a vacuum to try to work on future stuff, and knowing that my partners are out there.
So you can listen to music on your commute to work.
Yeah, which is a 10-foot walk, yeah. Really short material. But, you know, it's important to stay in touch, and I'm lucky to have partners who basically live for that process and really like it. So I know if there's something I need to hear or check out, they'll tell me about it.
Wow. How you doing, Brandon?
Doing good, man. What's going on?
I wanted to talk to Brandon a little bit because Brandon just finished working on the Terminator 4 trailer, and it was pretty cool. I got to tell you guys a funny story. I was listening to the Terminator trailer, and I got my iPhone out, and I use this program called Shazam, which can identify music and tell you where to get it. And so I held it up to the speaker, and it's playing, and it said, you know, Nine Inch Nails, The Day the World Went Away. And I go, it's awesome. I got to buy that album. So I didn't even buy the single. I bought the whole album, right? And I get back, and I listen to it, and it's not what I heard in the trailer at all. And I'm like, oh,
what a scam.
You know?
What a scam.
Well, it comes to find out that Brandon here, you know, did the beefy version for the trailer.
I was in the building the
whole
time.
He was in the building the whole time. And so, you know, I wanted to talk to Brandon about that because it's kind of cool. If you know anything about the song, it's kind of mellow and it has that Nine Inch Nails kind of aggressive guitar and stuff. But well, why don't you tell the story about how it got into the T4 trailer. Yeah. And what you did with it and how you juiced it a little.
I think it began with one of the producers. We produced two great trailers already. Two editors cut two really good trailers. Producer came in from Warner Brothers, said, let's try something sort of out of the box, something new, maybe try to brand it with a song. And he threw out Nine Inch Nails. It's like, maybe let's try a Nine Inch Nails thing.
So our music supervisor went and scoured through all the Nine Inch Nails and found this track, which was perfect, like lyrically perfect, the day the whole world went away. And it also has a line, I listened to the words he says, and there's a scene where Christian Bale, John Connor's on the walkie-talkie giving his, like, speech or whatever. So we grabbed that song, but we're like, this song is perfect, but it does not have drums. It doesn't kick you in the balls. You know, it's like, it's just this wall of guitars, but there's nothing low there hitting it. So I was like, all right, grabbed it, took it, put it into, Ableton, warped it, to the beat. It was about 131 BPM, warped it to that, and then added my own drum track underneath of it, more of like a John Bonham thing, like a, like big, you know, big, big drums there with very loose, like Bonham type hi-hat, you know, type thing. It really simple, actually, you know, not a ton to it, but, and then laid it under there. And it wasn't technically a remix at that point because it's all going into an editor's, Final Cut project. So for licensing purposes, I renamed that track Massive Drums and stuck it underneath of it. And we just had the Nine Inch Nails cue in there, and that went out in the trailer. And, then we did some other cool things with it, like musically, sound design wise, where we took, like, I had this thing I had created called a super slow-mo dramatic helicopter thump, which is, you know, I did it with synths, but that type of thing. Took that and warped it again to 131 in Ableton, and so you got like right when there's an image of a helicopter, and then. Also did a similar thing with some gunshots, you know, stuff like that in there. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
And the cool thing about it, you know, is if you, you know, we'll put a link to the trailer on the Audio Nowcast website. But what's really cool is the fact that the sound effects, like the helicopters, and even the opening graphic effects are all very musical, and it works so well. And now I know why, because it all came from the same place. And I just thought it was really, you know, you never think that there's some guy whose job it is to sweeten up music to use, you know, on a trailer. And to be honest, it really keeps the flavor of the Nine Inch Nail music. I mean,
I'm
it
curious,
doesn't.
Though, how does that work from a licensing standpoint? Though, when you're sort of altering the original work. How does that work?
Actually, I didn't mix it down.
Yeah.
I didn't mix it down together as one cue. Okay. As like Nine Inch Nails remix. I took it. We left the original track in there. The day the whole world went away, but okay. It was just like warped 131.
But your stuff, your additions would be just considered sound effects?
Yeah, we just considered it another music cue.
Well, I can actually tell you there, because we had firsthand experience with this, different licenses can specify whether you're allowed to overlap any other piece of music with a piece of music.
Okay.
Because there are some publishers that won't allow you to alter the cue.
Yeah, I thought some artists, I would imagine, would have a problem with that kind of thing.
We ran into a lot of that stuff in the trailers for Charlie's Angels way back. That was the first project I'd ever run into that on, because they were able to get sync and master licenses for some cues, but they had to be used in a specific way, and the artist was allowed to hear the final and approve it or not approve it if it was going to be layered with anything else. And there are licenses that say you can or can't change the original. But it's different. Every cue can be handled different.
And I think more and more, just because the only like three ways for an artist to make money anymore is, you know, live performance, ticket sales, licensing, and merchandise.
Yeah, they're more likely to be cool about
it. Record sales is a loss leader, basically. Right. So everyone's like, sure, take my music.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. And I know what Trent Reznor got paid for this. So.
It's not a problem.
I'm sure he wasn't complaining.
And like I said too, it's not, you know, it's not taking the song and taking it to a total left turn. I mean, it's very much in line with the whole Nine Inch Nails. I didn't even know they didn't do it that way, you know, obviously from my Shazam experience.
No, but as long as the publisher or the owner gets to say it's cool or not, it's great. I mean, as far as the audience knows, the audience doesn't know it's separate tracks.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
They just think it's a remix or whatever, and
yeah.
They might even want to go
buy
it.
I think it's pretty amazing that Shazam recognized it anyway then.
Yeah,
that was actually so cool from the original.
But I think it just shows how much wasn't touched, you know, how it was around the edges. It didn't tweak the basic song.
Right. And it makes you wonder what Shazam is focusing in on, though.
Probably pitch.
Yeah, melody, though. It must be melody. Yeah.
Wow.
Because drums wouldn't really. I'm not.
But you would think maybe it would.
Some of the beats.
But you would think it would go off a tempo. I mean, that'd be the easiest thing.
No, but I think it's melody because it's. I mean, I should imagine. I was just trying to think. They've got to try and work out what's being played, and what interval changes are being played, and then they can decipher what the tempo is. And if the tempo change,
yeah, tempo is secondary to the melody itself because there are plenty of songs at the same.
Well, the interval change. I mean, it's like okay, well, that's that.
Aren't they just analyzing the waveform though?
Well, they are, but you know,
they do pitch detection.
They got to do pitch detection.
Yeah.
Because
right,
you know, you could do. I mean, I'm sure there's you could do like 25,000 blues songs that all sound the same.
Yeah,
same
true.
Tempo. It's like oh, okay.
Plus, if you
but there's a melody.
Off
on
of
there,
the radio, the high frequencies are all the lows are, you know.
Yeah.
To probably have a small band.
What was that?
You're right.
It also
really
has to work through a telephone microphone, so it's not.
Yeah.
It's not analyzing 20K.
See, I just think it's the gnomes.
Yeah. It puzzles me that the iPhone can decipher what song is playing, like on a speaker, like halfway through the. Or whatever, and tell you, oh, it's amazing. But when somebody uses the iPhone to call me, I can never understand what they're saying.
So there's a million people in India that knows five songs each.
Oh, that's that.
And they all listen to say, oh, that's someone. Okay, next.
That's funny. That is funny.
It would actually be very interesting to put up a blues song. Well, like a really typical song with a typical melody. There's quite a few of them the same. I tell you, any one of the R&B artists these days have a little trouble deciphering the melody, basically.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not flawless.
It can't be. It's amazing.
I've stumped it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I use it all the time, though. It's great.
Yeah,
you know?
Cool.
And it can work when there's a remarkable amount of noise. That's the thing that I found was unique.
We should whistle a melody now. Whistle literally a unitone.
Okay,
we're gonna see if it picks it
up. This makes great radio.
Yeah, let's do something visual.
it's the whole waveform of the sound, though. It's not just simply the melody. That is gonna make my head explode.
All right, ready? Because I can always edit this out.
Okay.
Nice vibrato.
Let's see what it says.
It says 9-inch nails on a chalkboard.
It says unrecognized.
Exactly.
See, so I think it needs a little bit more.
But it's the whole pattern of the waveform.
But anyhow, you know, and getting back to the whole 9-inch nails thing, you know, the other thing too is they were using the song for, you know, freaking Terminator 4, so it's not like it was being used for a small trailer. It's going to be one of the bigger blockbusters. So
no, and they get paid very well. Yes, they do.
But anyhow, so if you're out there and you go see the trailer that's playing right now, just remember Brandon did a lot of work on that thing.
I think it's trailer number 3.
And Brandon's selling the actual remix version himself from his own website.
Trent might have a problem with it.
Don't tell anybody.
You mean Trent. We'll make it work.
Trent's on his way to your house now.
I don't think we're there. All of a sudden, hey, where did Brandon go?
He's up in Bel Air. With his own hand.
No, he's in Trent's dungeon.
Hey, guys, we're running out of time, but I kind of want to wrap up with a few things. And one thing I wanted to do was... I wanted to, last podcast, we had a viewer question. And actually we got a bunch of viewer questions, but we're only going to do one right now. There was a guy named Adam on the website who, wanted to find out two things. See, I've got two really good questions, so I'm trying to figure out which one.
Bring them on. We can do it, Adam.
Okay.
Quick. Bring them all. How many are there?
Okay, just two, really quick. But these can actually lead into even more conversation.
Come on. Okay.
Okay, when you're working on a deadline,
yep.
Do you compromise on the music or the mix?
Both.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just got to get it done.
Got to get it done. Best to have something good now than something brilliant tomorrow. That's the saying. That's true.
Compromise on sleep.
So
oh, sleeps. That's a given.
So you do less music and less mix, or do you do great music and less? I mean,
actually, you know what? I would say in our case, if there is a balance that has to be found, we'll end up skimping on the mix a bit, because the truth is, most of the time when you get a mix to the 80% mark,
right,
that last 20%, no one's going to really notice. I mean, you'll notice it because you're doing it and you're so close to it, but I think once you get your mix 80 to where you're 70, 80% happy with it, your client is not going to notice anything you do after that. So
depending on the deadline as well, if the music is superior, the deadline could be extended to finish a mix in a lot of cases, particularly for records anyway. I don't know about television, is probably a harder deadline often, but for records, things can often be extended.
Projects are never finished, they're abandoned.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is,
has mixes.
One of my favorite slogans, too, is there's never time to do it right, but always time to do it over. So if you give them a mix and you say, listen, we ran out of time, but check it out, it's an amazing piece of music, they'll let you have extra time to fix the mix.
I would emphasize the music. If you had to pick one.
I would tend to agree with that one also, because that's going to be the hook that's going to draw them in.
But lots of times I find myself, I'm like, okay, I know this has got to be done this way, but we need to get this section here, but I just don't have time to finish it, and this is going to work as it is.
It really depends on the business you're talking about. Records. If you're writing a jingle.
Film? Not a record.
In film, there's dates that you do not miss. It's not like, maybe they'll give us more time. When you've got a release date, and I can't tell you how many times I've gotten CG during Printmaster, and all of a sudden they go, boom, here it is. And I'll get 6 months to create all the design, but then all of a sudden CG comes in, and you got hours. You have minutes.
Especially
come up with something brilliant, figure it out. And is it everything I want to do? Absolutely not.
Right.
But I'm sitting there. It's 11:30 at night. And I just got finished a month ago. All the CG came in. It's 11:30 at night. Everybody wants to go home. They're looking at me. It's not like, take me 8 hours. I'll see you guys in the morning. No, it's like, give me 10 minutes. Let me see what I can do.
Hey, give me my ignorance. Give me, what's CG?
Oh, computer graphics?
Thank you. Okay.
I remember doing TV stuff way back, and we had like satellite time booked,
right,
which was very expensive from LA to New York.
Right.
And the music had to be sent there. The guy was on the other side, it was an expensive thing. And then, like, I'm not transmitting hiss, so you better have some music here. So it's like, I don't care. The lyrics are not finished. Oh, the mix is not finished. Like, send us anything.
But there's art and there's commercial art.
Absolutely.
Commercial art needs to be done. Boom.
Yep.
It's got to go. It's got to air.
But part of your job is to always put yourself in the mindset of the client, too. There are plenty of times when you're fixing something to please yourself, not the client.
Absolutely. I mean,
and you've got to be realistic about
that. When you're very good at what you do, you can make it good very quickly.
Yeah, that's true.
You may not make it great, but you'll make it good.
Yep.
And that's what they're counting on.
Yes. And so it's like, boom, okay, now it's good enough.
Good enough is the key to everything. Good enough is the key to everything.
Well, I know in post-production, I do the 15-minute mix rule. I start with a mix, boom, 15 minutes, I get something usable, and then I just make it better from there, make it better from there, make it better from there. Cause you never know when it's gonna be okay. And one time I worked on a commercial, and literally they had the satellite time booked, and I had 20 minutes to do a 60-second spot, compression, okay, it's out, boom, there it is. It aired the next day.
I mean, my best mixes happen if I do 3 passes. That means I mix it 3 different times. First time, you get everything covered, it's all there, it's maybe not great. Whatever you started the first day doesn't sound as good as what you started on the last day. Then you got to go back, even it out, because now all of a sudden you really keyed in. And then you do that, and then you listen to it again, you go, now let's just do the fine-tuning on it. And the thing is, you can't hear the difference.
Yeah. I normally take about 4 hours to get the mix together, and I take the rest of 9 hours to ruin it. But I'll put it on the way.
I don't work on any important projects with deadlines, so I don't have any problem.
You should be lucky. You know what I never understood, though, especially in audio, in the post or the film world, but they spend all this money on the visuals. They spend all this money getting the look on CG. But they always cut into the audio part of it. And so the hard deadline never ends. It just gets squished, 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 squished.
Well, look at the TVs. I mean, the TVs are getting bigger, cooler, and sharper with shittier speakers.
Yep.
So I mean, it does say something about it. And people do – reality is people do react to the visuals.
Dude, talking about TV, I mean, a sidebar about direct television. Is anybody else completely pissed off about the volume changes between...
Oh, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, yeah.
It's like absolutely...
What, the FCC license? It doesn't exist.
It's like, dudes, get your...
Wait, what happened?
I don't know. Okay, what
Fox
happens
is... 60B,
yeah, exactly.
Too loud.
And you have like a 1080i broadcast, right? Oh, like a 16... Right. Whatever. Then all of a sudden, it seems to actually change when there's a 4:3 broadcast picture. The sound is like 9 dB louder, and it's like, hey, this is like ah. It's like,
well, is that commercial or is that program?
It's the difference between program and commercial, and then DirecTV's own advertising on their own satellite network is absolutely out,
well, 'cause a lot of times
out of law, man.
It's been years since I've been in this business, on that part of the business. Right. But it used to be that you can get the specs for every different network, and they're different.
You still can. You still can, like Discovery's different, Fox is different. And actually, Fox, speaking of Fox, like if you listen to The Simpsons aren't loud. The Simpsons are relatively a lower volume show. Listen to their commercials, though, and the commercials are blaring. And that's because the commercial guys, man, they, you know.
But watch 24. Well, yeah, you crank the volume up. It's really good. Commercial comms wakes up the house.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, the program specs, that's the difference. The program spec is different than the commercial spec, and the commercial spec
is commercials, everything's got to be louder because people will buy it.
But you would think someone at the network would realize just how jarring and jolting it is.
I think they need to get a little letter or some kind of like class action against them, saying, listen, dudes, do you know, or contact the advertisers and say, listen, you're selling Colgate new toothpaste and I'm switching you down. I don't want to buy it.
There used to be a concept with volumes when I used to do commercials that it used to be that, oh, commercial's on, I'm going to the refrigerator and I'm going to pull something out. Well, guess what you get to hear really well on the other side of the room? The commercial.
Right.
But the problem is, with the home theater, everyone's sitting in their lazy boy lounger, and all of a sudden, bam!
Yeah.
But now Dolby's come out with a brand new box for broadcasters that's going to even out all the volumes.
Like it did for trailers.
But like they should have to do that. I mean,
they do. Like Discovery, you have to mix with the LM100, which essentially is their loudness meter, which takes an average on the curve, basically in your mid range, and you have to. They're Nazis when it comes to staying within the range of what they need.
But broadcasters, it's all kind of crazy because, you know, in digital they may go, oh, -12 is the highest peak volume you could use. Because of the broadcasting, blah, blah, you know, limitations of broadcast. It's all crap. I mean, it's you know, whether you're doing, you find out what zero is it -20 or +4 dB view, dBV? Is it -20? Is it -18? Is it -16? Those are kind of the standards. And then you figure out where dialogue is going to live, usually in that zero point. And then
a commercial comes on
because
all the
dialogue
time.
Dialogue is a really small, limited dynamic range.
Right.
I'm trying to work out a standard in video games. And I said, it's easy. They go, how do you know where music and effects are going to be? I said, you can't. You can't control it. Dialogue is only 6 dB range.
Mm-hmm.
So find the dialogue, live within 6 dB, and everything else after that is artistic. If you want it loud, if you want it soft.
The truth is, though, having a box like that Dolby box, that the same thing that happened with trailers, where, you know, trailers had gotten way out of control, and then the Dolby box came out and everybody had to run their trailers through the box, and things got a little more balanced.
Yeah.
You know, the theater owners weren't turning down the system to accommodate the trailers and then having them all the movies play too soft anymore, which was the problem originally.
Right.
And the same thing has to happen, because I've been at friends' houses with DirecTV, and you'd be watching a show at a normal level, and a commercial will come over just scare the crap out of you.
Well, that's because, you know, I'll tell you, for instance, when I mix commercials, you know, a lot of home entertainment stuff, you know, we're peaking about -10. We put like an L2, have a compressor, because my thing is I just want to keep it manageable. I don't want to be one of those ones that pop out. Commercial guys that do any of the big agencies, they're up at -6, -4, and that's freaking loud. The difference between -10 and -6, and most program levels, you know, around minus 10. So especially like PBS and things like that. So it's, that's why the commercials, they're not just louder. They are really loud. And then when you're slamming into the compressor of whatever, you know, network that you're, that is,
it gets crushed to
death.
Yeah,
it gets crushed. So it's even louder. It has that louder perception.
So all the rock engineers that aren't doing music anymore, they're doing now commercials because they're almost a hearing.
And, but you never, you know, they don't get nailed or anything because they're paying the bills. And it was really amazing the first time I saw the difference.
So what volume are you listening to, SPL level? In other words, you tune your room to 85,
right,
80, 82?
No, I tune – well, because most post rooms are a little on the smaller side. So you're about 80. Like when I'm doing something broadcast, I'll listen at 80. But, 85 but, will blow the bejeebies out of me.
But the standard, in other words, there is none. I mean, I've seen a lot of TV guys kind of go 80, 82, 85. The guys at 85 will mix lower. The guys at 79 and 80 who bring it down are going to bring it up louder to rock the room. If you're doing Terminator and you're doing a trailer, you listen at 80, oh, you got to rock the room a little bit.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is when you're doing TV, though, is you're switching to the Aura tones. I mean, I've got a pair of Aura tones. So ultimately, you're going to run your mix through that. So even if you're 80,
still
85.
Aura
tones? Yeah. You know, because look at the.
I love Aura tones.
Look at the, look at your stereo TVs. Those speakers, like you said, they're not great. They are. Even
a
though
lot
it's
of home
stereo,
theaters out now, though.
You're
but
right.
You know
but you can't
find,
mix just for that.
But you
I,
can't
but
mix.
What I find what's interesting, though, is when I'm watching a commercial, it's not really volume anymore. All of a sudden, I'll watch something mono, one commercial, another commercial is mono, all of a sudden, wham! A commercial goes 5-1, the whole room opens up, the music's wide, and all of a sudden you go, that's cool.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of home theaters out there. It's not that outrageous anymore.
Well, and things are going to change.
Thanks to Bose,
things are
going to
change drastically after June when everything goes digital. Because right now you're still kind of mixing, you know, to that analog compressor that's on, you know, that small station out in Indiana. But when everything goes digital, you're not going to have those same constraints. So it's going to be,
you're
I think
still
it's going
to
get
compression.
Yeah. But I think it's
going to
get, it's going to get worse before it gets better. Cause I think it's, I think it'll get better because
they had a man on the moon 39 years ago and they can't get the sound of stereo.
But now you can use all 16 bits. Cause it used to be, no, I know. A
I
lot
know they
of,
are. They're all using
a lot
16
of,
bits.
But, you know, there was a decision. I've seen two philosophies in digital. Some people go, well, if I've got all the bits for me to use it, I have to use the whole dynamic range. Why am I going to take all of it, you know, take it and stop at minus 10? I'm not, you know, it's like 12-bit, you know, go through the whole range.
Resolution,
and get,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's true
so,
but, in the middle of the process. That's
right.
True.
So if you're doing that, that's – so I know some people mix going, I want it full range. And then when it goes to broadcast, you're killing people. Other people who were from the tape days – which goes, it really doesn't matter quality-wise if I'm at any of the levels. So there's different schools of philosophy.
Talking about tape days, a sidebar, an old – oh, what, you got to go?
We're running out of time, but go ahead. Make it quick.
Tape days, when you used to mix to quarter-inch, half-inch analog tape, right? Yeah. You used to want to go – and you send it to your mastering engineer to cut it in the days of vinyl, if you remember that.
Yeah.
You used to send them in to get it cut, right? So what you used to do is you want to make your music sound louder than everybody else. It's the same concept, basically. So you have to put a 1K tone, 10K, and 100 hertz at the top of the tape so the guys could align the tape for EQ and everything. But the 1K tone, you used to line up at like a dB or two down. But used to say it's zero, so you'd write on the box 320 nanoevers plus 3
right.
equals zero, but
right.
meanwhile it's not. So right. the guy would be like, oh man, this guy's down a bit, so he'd crank it up, so he'd print you a nice big vinyl check.
Smiley curve and all that. Yeah.
And that's used to be for dance remixes, for the 12-inch, you used to print a 12-inch, you used to slam the thing. So that's why you put on 12-inch, like, hello.
Until the cutter head started bouncing out.
Well, that's what the 670 was there for. You say, nope, you're not going anywhere.
Anyway, why don't they do that on television, though? Why don't they put a massive limiter on
that? That's what I was getting to. I'm like, dudes, hello. No, it's not that hard. Most of them are like,
you know what, though, it'll
IQ
come.
Of 3. So
but you're listening to HBO and Showtime, and they're much more sophisticated in their audio.
It's the commercials that have to, you know, those have to get pulled back into the realm of reality.
We did a trailer. I guess I can't say. Can I say which trailer that was?
I was about to talk about it, too.
Okay. We did, Rob and I did a trailer together, Godzilla.
I'm proud to say I wrote the music for the loudest trailer in history.
Yes. And
the trailer
and
that
we
actually
designed it.
The trailer that actually caused that box, the Dolby box, to come into being.
It was so loud. We were mixing it at that time. There was a studio called Vine Street. And it was so loud, they kept bringing the volume up, and no, it's going to be loud, it's going to be loud. And it was far beyond anything you could put on any kind of storage medium. So at that point, I just said, crank up the monitors. It's just all kind of, you know, for naught. It was so loud, and Vine Street has so many walls and so soundproofed, you heard it from the street. Every time Godzilla stepped, you were like, what the hell was that? And it was outside. It wasn't outside the room.
It was the loudest thing I'd ever heard indoors.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. Wow. And we used a 100-piece symphony orchestra, and it was dwarfed by those footsteps.
They wanted it to be rock concert. We did a version over at Show West. We put seat shakers in.
Wow.
So when the footsteps happened, literally, your body moved from the seat shakers. And this trailer person was so into it, like, I can't feel it. I'm like,
then you're dead. You know, if you can't feel that, you're dead.
To get it to that volume,
right.
Nobody's going to reproduce it.
Wow. Well, thanks, Rob.
No, actually, it was the footsteps are what pushed it over the limit.
All right, thanks, Scott. Well, hey, we got to wrap up because we're going a little long. But, wow, good show, guys. And, Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What are you working on right now? Are you doing anything?
Let's see. Developing some – I have a couple artists. I just signed an 18-year-old girl from Modesto, of all places.
Wow.
And, I'm trying to develop my own stuff. I need to get a piece of the pie that's sending artists out with hit songs, and they go out and tour and make all the money, and I'm sitting here trying to pay to keep the lights on. You know, so I'm trying to get a bigger share.
But it's glamorous, right?
Yeah, sure.
Super ultra.
Sure. Hey, and Brandon, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And telling us a little bit about T4. What other trailers are playing right now that you've done some stuff on?
What else? Right now I'm working on something that it's not out called Whiteout, which is, you know, a horror type thing. Scary snow, whatever.
Scary snow.
I've nicknamed it Snow Beast.
Scary snow.
Rob, what about you?
Yeah, what about me? I'm actually working on there's a lot of things I can't talk about. Just had a listening event for the new Orbit Monkey album, which is up at orbitmonkey.com and on iTunes. And we had a listening event that was sponsored by Sonar, actually Cakewalk Sonar.
Wow.
Because the album was actually recorded in Sonar.
Wow.
And they're going to be talking it up quite a bit because it sounds really good, and it'll be a nice high-profile project that was done in Sonar. So we're doing some promotion for that. And I've actually been designing a lot of website stuff that is going to start to be popping up at noisyneighbors.com, hopefully around the time this posts.
Hopefully summerfieldmusic.com soon.
yeah, well, we're going to work on that too.
And Scott, yourself, I know Crank is out right now.
Well, actually, today, this weekend, is the premiere of Star Trek.
Did you work on it?
I did.
Nice.
I did. So yeah. So we're excited to see what that does, and we've got all these movies coming out.
Any signature sounds we should listen for that you know?
I did the phasers, photon torpedoes, exterior of the Enterprise, jellyfish weapons. I was a weapons guy.
Nice.
I get to blow things up and shoot things.
Nice.
And then I just started my next project called Season of the Witch.
Wow.
Which comes out, I don't know when that comes out, actually.
Well, it looks amazing.
Sometime this year.
And Star Trek was all just factory sounds from a synth?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I got a really giant coil cable.
Hey, did you go to the premiere? Did you see the premiere? That premiere was huge.
Oh, yeah, from our building.
Yes.
You could see it.
It was great. They built a big giant chevron of the Star Trek chevron, and they had brought stands in, and they shut down whole Hollywood Boulevard. I mean, it was a huge premiere. I've never seen a premiere as big as that one.
Wow.
That's why I was wondering if
that's
you wanted
killing.
To.
I was wired in my studio.
Yeah, it's right.
Hey, we're going to have to talk about that next time, because we'll talk about Scott's new studio that he just put into his house and the trials and tribulations, because we've been hearing about it for a long time.
Especially Bobby.
And now that it's done, you can hear about
midnight.
It.
I got a question.
It's the wet side.
And Bobby, you working on anything fun? Exciting?
Actually, I've got a couple of things hopefully coming off that's going to be fun. Last week wasn't much fun other than doing Actually, Greg worked on the
she
demo.
She said it was pretty fun.
Yeah, well, yeah,
that's
yeah.
true.
His wife tells him everything, I think.
Oh, no!
Anyway, actually, I don't know if I can actually... Blah.
Nope, in, no.
It's NDA. Sorry, I can't.
Can't do
anyway,
it.
That's good.
Anyway, it's fun. Actually, interestingly enough, though, Martin Page called me up and said, hey, he's been approached to write a song for a new... for I won't mention the name of the band,
right.
Anyway. And they're getting together, and they and he said, "Hey, do you want to do it together?" So I said, "Man, it's amazing!" So we got together last night and just talked about possibly writing a little track together. It's going to be fun.
Wow.
for a band that was big in the '80s and is going to do a rerun. So that's what I'm doing. Other than that, looking after my dog and trading.
Hey, by the way, before we go, did you make the deadline? I called Bobby up,
yeah.
And he was like, can't talk right now, mate. Got a deadline, 9 o'clock.
What time did you call me?
I called you at like 10 to 9 or something. I mean, it was...
What was my deadline? 10 to 9.
Oh, okay.
I had to deliver this thing, and I... Anyway, whatever. I was late, and what? I was like, hi, Mike, yes, no, bye.
But I was just thinking, wow, a 9 a.m. deadline. You know what that means. That's not really 9 a.m. That's... 9:02 p.m., right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you were probably up the whole night before.
Well, actually, the whole night before, we had a little social gathering at my place, and I ended up literally mixing it while the people were at the house. I was like, okay, I went and printed it.
He had to be antisocial.
I did for a moment.
Just for a moment.
3-minute print and left.
But it's a really cool piece, so we'll be hearing
you're
about
very
it.
Kind.
We'll
Thank
be
you.
Hearing about it eventually.
All right, well, hey, if you have any questions.
You've really upped the game for the porn music.
It's really good. I thought the gazoo, instead of sax, is actually
it's really good.
Especially the way she played it.
Wow.
Anyway.
Wow.
Anyway, you were saying, Mike?
I have no idea now. No, hey, if you have any questions or comments for us at the Audio Nowcast, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. I don't know when we'll answer your question, but we will answer your question.
Did we get to both of the questions?
No, we didn't.
No, we did one.
But
we're
out of time. We'll save it for next time.
Did you say...
We'll save it for next time. We'll save them all for next time.
It's anticipation. Yeah.
Also, you can check us out at Audio Nowcast, our MySpace page. That's MySpace/AudioNowcast. And from there, you can also check us out on Facebook. So there's a lot of ways to come and interact and ask us questions. So for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.